You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, hey, music fans, welcome to Modern Musicology. My name is Alan, and this week I am unfortunately not joined by my co-hosts, Rob and Stephanie. They will be back with us next week when we have a very special guest. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. But this week we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of one of my favorite bands in the history of the world, and that is Rush. We are coming up on the 50th anniversary of the release of their debut album, creatively called Rush. And I have two very special guests joining me to talk about this. The first is a lovely gentleman called Jerry Schramm from the Something for Nothing podcast. Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing great, Alan. Thanks for having me back. This is my second time.
Second time. That's right.
Two-timer.
Exactly. And joining us is one of my best friends on the whole planet, and that is Vicky Hudson, lead singer of the Rush tribute band, The Spirit of Rush. Vicky, what is this third time, I think, that you've been on with us?
I'm pretty sure it is. The third time's the charm. Last time we talked about Ghost, and I think the first time we talked about Rush. Yeah,
we sure did. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back. And then Jerry, I guess I was on your podcast like four times. So
that's right.
We've got this whole intermingling going on. It's awesome.
Yeah. So you two have known each other before I ever met Jerry. And I think maybe before I met Vicky. And I know, Jerry, you have flown over to see Vicky's band play and all kinds of stuff. And she has been on your podcast before. So this is a little Rush love fest that we have going on here.
That's right. Vicky allowed me on stage to play the triangle on Hemispheres.
That's right.
And you rocked it, let me tell you.
I hit my cue and then got off the stage as quickly as possible.
The audience went nuts for him.
That is an honor that Jerry and I share because I got to do it at a different show a year or so later.
That's awesome.
It was fun. I tell you. My shining moment on my triangle solo.
That was very cool. I only let people I really trust do it because if you miss it, it's sort of a real bummer.
Ruins the whole song.
Totally.
So we're going to talk first about the debut album, which came out on March 18th, 1974. And then we're going to get into some of our other Rush stories from across the decades. But going back to that first album, when you kind of look at that album as a standalone release, this is the first thing that ever came out from Rush. This is the first thing that anybody would really know about them. What do you think makes this album special? What do you think it is that makes this debut something that is notable?
I think there's a certain rawness to it, just pure power, that you could already tell how amazing they were. And of course, it just kind of went up from there. But, you know, some people would say at the time the album came out that it sounded like Led Zeppelin or whatever. And I guess there's a little bit of that going on. But to me, it sounded like Rush, and it sounded like three guys, but Geddy and Alex in particular, who were just at the edge of really bursting out with their incredible raw talent. And they were so young, and yet they already shredded that much. And so I guess we can only look at it in hindsight because we now see everything that came after that and how that was just the beginning. But I can imagine people listening to that for the first time and just being hit by the sort of raw awesomeness of it and the power behind all three instruments, but particularly bass and guitar.
Yeah,
it's definitely a very heavy, might be one of their heaviest albums.
Yeah.
But just straight ahead rock and roll, which is completely different really than anything they did even, you know, a year later.
Yeah. And, you know, from what Vicky was saying, you know, I can listen to it and understand how it was kind of hard for them to get radio play. You know, this doesn't really fit anywhere. It doesn't really fit in what radio was doing at the time. And, you know, everybody knows the story about how Working Man eventually got picked up and broke them. And that's what kind of started the ball rolling. But up until that point, you know, it was hard for them to get anything, any action on any radio market.
Yeah. And there might have already been an early prejudice against Getty's voice, you know, because even though he wasn't singing at his highest registers on that album,
yeah,
it was still a unique voice that, of course, all three of us worship, but there were people who were probably going, what on earth is this? And, you know, it's kind of like, in a way, that theme of not fitting in stayed with Rush for their entire career. I mean, you think about even later after they proved themselves over and over again, they still had a hard time with the critics. And so mm-hmm. I'm not terribly shocked that they had a hard time getting radio play initially, because that's sort of a theme that they just never fit completely anywhere. They were always their own style and their own thing. And that's what we love about them.
Absolutely.
Right. And it seems like when they did get radio airplay, it's not like they were doing anything. It's almost like the culture itself, or the fan base itself, was kind of cresting some kind of wave that caught up to them.
True.
And then just kind of dropped off. And they caught up to them again later, because they've had, you know, ups and downs of popularity wise.
Yeah, very true.
So, you know, I hadn't really initially thought about this question, but Vicky, since you brought it up, since you brought up the angle of the voice, it is your job in the spirit of Rush to do Getty's vocals. So what was it about tackling that for the first time? Did you find any difficulties? Were there certain challenges that you faced? And how was it that you overcame those?
This might sound weird, but it really wasn't that challenging initially, because I had been listening to that music since I was 13 or 14 years old. And it was so natural, and it was so much a part of me. I had studied without realizing I was studying every nuance right. of every song that Getty sang. And so by the time I was in a performance jam group before I was with Spirit of Rush, and we did a few Rush covers, and the first time I ever did it, it was like the most natural thing in the world. And what I didn't realize, though, is that, you know, we played Spirit of Radio. I think we played Passage to Bangkok. So those songs were quite well absorbed in me, and it was pretty easy to just sing those. What I didn't realize, though, is for some of their stuff, you can sing along with the CD and think you know the song and, until you have to carry it yourself, and you realize, like, a song like Driven, you know,
oh yeah,
it's easy to sing along with it. But when you have to carry it, there's all these weird timing patterns that seem very natural when you're listening. Mm-hmm. But when you have to sing it, you realize, oh gosh, I'm sitting there writing stuff down, counting in my head. So I think that was the challenge. And then memorizing all the lyrics is another thing. You think you know all the lyrics because yes. you're singing along with the CD. And so I could sing the entire 2112 along with Getty on the record. But as soon as I had to do it myself, I realized how many were not as embedded as I thought they were. So I had to come up with all of these techniques to memorize lyrics. So I have, I do a multi-pronged approach. I do hand gestures to put the muscle memory in. So I actually have gestures for all the storylines and all the, you know, and then I repeat lines over and over. So if there's one line I'm getting stuck on, I just repeat it over and over. And then I have a third prong, which is like writing. So I have a notebook in front of me. And if I get stuck on some lyrics, then I just write them. And I have little like acronyms that I use, and so it kind of took multiple thought patterns and ways of doing things to get all those things embedded, but it's much more comfortable now.
Yeah. And you do it beautifully, I'll just say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a lot of fun, and it's an honor.
And, you know, we've talked about this before, but the audiences that come to your shows are incredible.
They are incredible. I always say we have the best fans in the world, and that is not an exaggeration at all.
Right.
They're so supportive and generous and everything. They're amazing.
Right. And I want to get into that a little bit later on about Rush's audience, but sticking to the first album a little bit more, what are some of the things about the style of this first album do you hear in later Rush music? Like, you know, they really get away from this when they're getting into stuff like Xanadu and, you know, those kind of albums, and into the more flowery prog kind of music. But to my ear, they do a little bit of return to this in the 90s. And I want to know what you think about this. Like, how do you think that this first album fits into the overall spectrum of Rush music? And what about it do you think that they return to at a later point, if they even do, if you think that they do? Because it's a pretty unique album for Rush.
It is. And I was thinking about that today, because the thing that is most Rush-like about this Rush album is that it's not like any other Rush album.
Right.
Every single Rush album is different than every other Rush album.
That's very true.
So it seems like the anomaly in a huge catalog that it's so straightforward. You know, it's very, you know, blues rock influenced. The lyrics aren't the greatest lyrics in the world, but it definitely fits in with that theme of, we're just going to try this thing now, and then we're going to grow later on or change later on.
Yeah. That's a really good point, that it is so Rush-like that it's not like anything else that they ever did. They don't like to repeat themselves, and I guess this is sort of proof of that. The time signatures in this first album are very straightforward. And to some extent, I guess, Alan, to answer your question, they go back to a little bit of that, maybe in Counterparts.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit in Test for Echo. But these are the songs on the first album for our band that we have to practice the least, because the timing is just, you know, it's pretty straightforward.
Right. And that's kind of what was in my mind as well, is that as far as song structure, time signatures, that kind of thing, they kind of returned to a little bit of that style in the 90s.
But, yeah.
So what are some of the standout tracks? The two that sort of like remained in circulation in set lists for a long time were In the Mood, which got carried up through like at least the late 80s. They were still doing that one. And Working Man, which we've had in set lists all the way to the very end.
Right.
What are some of the other things that stand out to you on this album?
Well, Finding My Way is a great album opener. Rush always has great album openers.
Man, I love that song.
Right. It's such a great riff, and just the way it, you know, opens up so slowly and just kind of crashes in. It's a great way to open an album. And they always do that perfectly.
Yeah.
So true. I love What You're Doing, because it's such a stick it to the man kind of song. And so if you're having one of those days, you know, you just put that song on if you're dealing with bureaucracy or some kind of difficulty with the man, whatever that might be. It's the powerful riff, but it's also just that whole, you know, the lyrics of see you standing there with your finger in the air, you know, it's, I don't know. I love the rebelliousness of that tune.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun to play as well.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun for us in your audience to hear, I will say.
Glad to hear that.
I know lyrically it's a little bit simple and it's a really short song, but I really kind of dig Need Some Love. It's just fun, you know? Yeah. There's nothing more deep to it than that. It's just a fun song. But I also really love Before and After.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really great song. It's got a great structure to it. And there's everything about it I just really enjoy.
The whole thing really flows so well together.
It does.
I mean, the order of the songs is particularly good. It kind of goes from, you know, the powerhouse of the opener, Finding My Way. But then you've got the fun of Need Some Love and Take a Friend. And then Here Again, kind of slowing things down a little bit. And yeah, I don't know. It just seems to have a good structure for a debut album.
And I think it works, you know, this is not a factor when it first got released, but I think it works really well on CD. I think you don't get that sense of this is where side one ends, this is where side two begins. You know, it doesn't have that thematic break, you know. It just feels like it starts and then it goes all the way through. It just flows beautifully. And a lot of albums don't do that from the 70s. A lot of them have a very clear side one, side two, even when you mash them together in one continuous flow, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
And there's a great box set of this album. I don't know how many people are aware of that, but I stumbled on it in a record store and I was so thrilled. So it has the vinyl album and then it has like all of these promotional pictures from when it was released. And it has like the inside of the cover looks like the master tape labeled with all the songs. And it has a Rush family tree poster. So it shows how all these different members of Rush and crew were connected throughout the years. And it's really cool. So if anyone is a collector of Rush memorabilia, but may not know that that box set exists because they didn't promote it as widely as, say, the Signals or Moving Pictures anniversary. And it came out, I believe, last year, but it's well worth it to pick that up.
Very cool. Very cool.
I've never even heard of that.
I was going to say the same thing.
They didn't do a 40th anniversary box set with, like they did with some of their other albums, right?
No. No, I don't even know if this was released as like a lead up to the 50th. I'm not even really sure, but it's awesome. I just stumbled on it and I'm so delighted that I found it. So definitely pick that up.
Okay, there's one last thing that I want to talk about the debut album, and it's something that I feel like is, you know, completely unique to the first album. And so we just have to talk about it. Everything changed for Rush after this album, and a new member came into the fold, and that is, of course, the legendary Neil Peart. But I want to talk about John. I want to talk about John Rutsey and his role on this album and what you think of his style and what you think he contributed to their sound at this point.
Well, I think he's a great drummer. I mean, he's not the kind of drummer that Neil is, but he's a really good drummer. I mean, I remember a long time ago when I was trying to, you know, when you're first a Rush fan, you try to get everybody you know to be a Rush fan.
Yes.
You become an evangelical all of a sudden. You know, you're going all over the world just trying to convince other people that this is the greatest band that's ever existed. So I did that with my brother and I gave him all the albums or whatever. And I gave him the first album and we were talking about the first album and how different it was than all the other ones. And he was like, yeah, I mean, you know, even Neil is blah, blah, blah. He talks about Neil. I'm like, Neil's not playing on that album. And he didn't know, you know, he didn't. Wow. Because it's just, he's a good drummer. It's unfortunate that he was followed by Neil.
Yeah.
Really. Exactly.
Yeah. Totally agree with that. Not only was he a great drummer, but he was a great sort of quasi front person, even though he was sitting in the back. He was very charismatic with the audience. You know, he would talk to them and introduce songs and he would do a lot of the talking in the early shows. So he was a great stage presence character. And he had some really cool, unique fills and riffs of his own style of his own, which I really enjoyed. And it's interesting to hear Neil build upon some of his stuff.
Yes.
And put his own Neil twist on it. When you hear like versions of, you know, there's some live CDs, like rare live CDs that I have of right when Neil joined the band and he was playing their first stuff from their first album and the things that he adds, it's like, you really realize that Neil is just at this whole other level.
Right.
And of course he had to have a solid foundation to build on and add those things to. So.
And I, you know, this may be common knowledge to every hardcore Rush fan, but I did not know this until I read Getty's book. And the intention was that John was going to be the lyricist for the band.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
That's one of the, there are two things to me about the first album that make Rush, Rush, is that John didn't provide the lyrics when he was supposed to. He was supposed to be the lyricist. And then the time come for Getty to actually record the lyrics, John was supposed to deliver them and have them done, and didn't show up into the studio, and he said he was so upset with them or dissatisfied with them that he just tore them all up. So Getty had to do it. And that was one of the, I think that was like the final straw when it came to John being in the band. There were other problems with John. They were having just a stylistic thing as well.
Yeah.
But then it was recorded very poorly. It didn't have the kind of oomph, didn't have the kind of sound it has. And that's when they got Terry Brown to come in and fix things in the 12th hour or the 11th hour. And real 12th hour, that doesn't make any sense. He came in at the end. Edit that out and put, he came in at the end and really, you know, made the album sound like it was supposed to sound. And then they kept him for a number of years.
Quite a few of those years.
The 12th hour makes it sound like it was even more urgent.
It was so late. It was even later than late.
Exactly.
Right.
It's like he barely made it.
Right. Well, okay. So to transition out a little bit from the first album, since we're talking about Getty's book, what a reading experience that was. And I know both of you saw him on his book tour, and I am so anxious to hear some stories from your experience seeing Getty talk about this book.
Oh my gosh. What a night. I don't even know where to start, but I'll just say that the first thing that happened to me, I went to LA to see him. That's my hometown, and had some stuff to do out there. So I saw him at the Orpheum Theater in downtown LA. And I heard from some of the Rush fans that they were going to meet up beforehand in a little pub that was near the theater. So I go to the pub and I walk in, and this guy like points at me and he's like, "Oh my God, you're Vicky from Spirit of Rush." And I was like, "What?"
Oh, great.
And apparently he had seen during the pandemic, you know, we did five live streams from our garage that we broadcast all over the world. And that guy had seen several of them apparently. And he said him and his wife would like look forward to, you know, when they were announced, and they would go in the basement with the TV and, you know, fire it up and enjoy the show. And he was just so appreciative. And I mean, I was completely blown away. I was almost in tears because it was to know that I helped somebody on the other side of the country was really amazing. So we go into the theater and the line for the merchandise was so long. And there was a shirt I really wanted, but I was like, I don't want to miss 1 second of Getty. I don't want to miss him walking on stage or any of that.
Yeah.
And so that same guy who had seen me said, "Well, I'm going to get in the line anyway. And, you know, tell me what you want." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, do you have Venmo? Because I want to make sure I can pay you back." He said, "Yeah, I have Venmo." Okay, cool. He gets in the line. I go into the theater. I'm by myself. My husband wasn't able to come with me. And when Getty walked out on stage, I mean, the feeling of seeing him again after missing him so much and seeing him look healthy and happy and doing something new. And, you know, I mean, again, the tears started welling up because it was, you just realize like how much you miss those guys, you know, you remember the feeling of what it was like to anticipate a Rush show or a new Rush album, and that's all gone now. You know, there's a void there that can't be filled. Yep. And all of a sudden, Getty's walking on stage again, and I was just overwhelmed with emotion. And of course, he was charming and funny and fun, and he just seemed to appreciate the audience so much. Like, he seemed so willing and wanting to interact with us, and it was just... it was so much fun to hear his stories. And we had Jack Black as our interviewer, and he was hysterical, just as funny as could be. So he was a lot of fun too.
And a bit of a Rush expert himself. He knows what he's talking about when he's interviewing somebody like that.
Yeah. At one point he took out his cell phone and like started playing Xanadu into the mic. Like, and he was like, "Well, I was going to look at my notes on my phone, but then I'm like, well, wait a minute, why don't we just play some Rush?" So Xanadu's like blasting throughout the theater over his microphone, and it was
hilarious.
It was just hilarious. And after the show was over, I went back outside, and that guy had come out, and he hands me my shirt, and I said, "Okay, great, thank you so much." I'm like, what's your Venmo name?" And he's like, "No, I got you." And he said, "You did so much for us, you know, during the pandemic, and we appreciate you." And I was just completely blown away. And right outside of the theater were some members of two other Rush tribute bands in LA that I know either from being in person, meeting them in person, or just from their videos. And they recognized me and I recognized them. And we all took a picture together. And it was this beautiful, like, congregation of Rush tribute band members. It was just an absolutely magical night. I'll never forget it.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I saw Getty, it was the opening night of the tour. Paul Rudd was the guest interviewer.
Oh,
so man, that was great. It was really great seeing Getty again on stage. Yeah. I mean, we've gone to so many concerts over the years and just looked up to him so much. And the thing I loved about his book is how human it is, how non-rock starry it is, and how much he goes into the relationships that formed his life over his career, and how he sacrificed. It's kind of like Mission, right? The song Mission.
Yeah.
He sacrifices a lot for the band.
Yeah.
I mean, I just thought it was a very, very human kind of, I'm glad it wasn't just a litany of rock star excesses.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very human. And of course the chapter about his parents was so important.
Right.
And as a Jewish person, I cannot even, you know, I told Donna Halper, she and I talk from time to time, and I told her that I'm sure that he knows this, but when she saw him next to Please Convey from one Jew to another, how grateful I am that he told those stories, because some of the fans who will read the book are young enough not to really know that much about the Holocaust, or, you know, they might have heard of it vaguely, but the detail that he goes into, it's so important. And for someone of his stature to share that is going to just have a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important to share it so that people don't forget these stories. And so I'm super grateful to him for that.
Yeah.
I was holding it together emotionally until the very end of the chapter.
Yeah.
When they go, he takes his mom and I guess his brother and his sister also, they go to Auschwitz and they meet one of the soldiers who liberated the camp. And that's when I had to stop reading.
God.
It was so hard to read.
Yeah.
And you talk about any bio written by a rock star, you do not expect to get that kind of chapter.
Right.
I mean, what a bold thing. As you say, incredibly important thing. But I wonder if there was anybody else would have debated, do I include this? Do I not? And I am so thankful that he did. I mean,
same.
What a powerful read.
Yeah. And the ripple effect of that will continue on for decades, because Getty is so respected by so many. And so for him to share those stories, it's really going to mean something.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember any standout, funny or touching moment from Getty's interview?
I think he was talking about, he was talking about his wife. And how difficult life on the road is when you have a family.
Yeah.
And he seemed genuinely, just throughout his career, concerned with balancing his home life and his professional life. And I think he's come around as an older man, spending a lot of time with Nancy, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that came across like he's almost trying to make it up to her. After all of those years being away.
Yeah.
And he just really is enjoying, he still wants to play. You know, he's very busy, obviously. But he is really enjoying reconnecting with Nancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think for me, it was when he mentioned that Alex had been in the hospital with COVID.
Mm.
And was really seriously ill, was on a ventilator. And I didn't know that it had been that serious.
Yeah.
And both of you know me well enough to know that, you know, Alex is my musical hero of all time. He's not only my favorite guitarist, he's my favorite musician of all time. And when I heard that, I was just almost devastated in hindsight, you know, like retroactively or something. I couldn't believe that he had come that close to potentially losing his life, and that Geddy was very, like, just out of his mind because he had already lost Neil. And
yeah.
And so that was very, very hard. In some ways harder than the stuff in chapter three, because as a Jew, I grew up with Holocaust survivor stories. So it wasn't as shocking to me as maybe others, but
right.
Hearing that Alex had been, you know, on a ventilator, it was, and seeing Geddy's concern and, you know, their friendship is very touching.
Yes,
it is, right? They're like,
yeah,
just two best friends.
Besties. Yeah, 100%.
Making mustard and making beer.
Oh, have you had the mustard? It is literally the best mustard in the world. Oh my gosh, you are, if you like mustard and you haven't had the Rush mustard, you are seriously missing out.
I love Rush. I could go wrong.
Right.
Dude, but it's not, I mean, I thought I'm going to love it because it's Rush mustard, but honestly, like that aside, like Rush, if you took the label off, I'm not even joking. It is the best mustard I've ever had. I have mustard connoisseur. I love mustard.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
That it's amazing.
So I'm going to order some right now.
Right? Yeah, really. Listeners, order your Rush mustard now.
Seriously, you're missing out.
One of my favorite things about the book was that it basically, it's a story of these two best friends throughout their entire life. I mean, I just think that it was, because you just don't get that very often in anybody's story, much less in rock and roll, you know, that these two guys were there from the very beginning and all the way to the very end, and their friendship has remained intact. And one of the things that I've always loved about Rush, aside from the John Neil handoff, has been the same configuration for their entire career. Yeah. No other band has that.
Right.
That's amazing.
It's just amazing.
And the way that they just get along and they're still friends. I mean, how many bands have just been torn apart by musical differences or just personality differences? And they don't really, I mean, do they have musical differences? They have musical, they're different musically, but they don't have musical differences. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Nothing significant enough to drive a wedge. I mean, they might have had from maybe the whole keyboard debate, you know?
Yeah.
Might have been the closest they came, but even that they handled with grace, and friendship was still intact, and
you
know, they dealt with it.
Yep. So speaking of books, this is brand new information for me. You two already knew about this, but there's a new Neil Peart book coming out.
Yes.
That's crazy. Whoever expected that? So it's called Silver Surfers, Sports Cars of the 60s. So this is a very different kind of book from Mr. Peart. You excited about it? You're going to be getting it? I'm sure you're going to be getting it.
Absolutely. I will definitely be getting it. My husband's into old cars, and just to see Neil's perspective on that subject would be interesting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it's going to be, you know, like his books, part travelogue, part, who knows what it's going to be about, really. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I wonder if there'll be a red Barchetta in it.
That would be awesome.
Maybe a silver Barchetta.
A silver Barchetta.
Maybe. Yeah.
There you go. All right. So having been Rush fans, as long as the three of us are, we have seen Rush numerous times over the years. What are some of the favorite Rush shows that you've seen and some of your favorite concert memories from any various Rush show?
Wait, Alan, how many times have you seen them?
How many? I don't even know. The first time was on the Permanent Waves tour in 1980. And that was the third concert I ever saw.
And, wow.
Right. So Kiss was first. Oh, no, maybe it was fourth. Kiss was first in 79 and then Frampton. And then I don't remember if I saw Heart or Rush next. So it was either the third or fourth show I ever saw.
Wow.
And then the last one I saw was R40. And
right,
quite a few times in between there. I don't even know how many.
Amazing.
Vicky, how many times did you see them, Vicky?
23.
Yeah, mine doesn't go to 23. I'll just tell you that. It might be
and
a
I'm
dozen.
Counting a couple of events that didn't have all three of them, but that, like, I saw them at Saddle Rock Ranch in Malibu in 1990 for a benefit show that hardly anybody knew about. There were like 300 people there.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine? So Neil wasn't there, but Geddy and Alex played with Pat Torpey from Mr. Big as the drummer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some members of Kansas were there and some members, you know, different bands, and they kind of swapped out, and there was a barbecue, and Geddy and Alex are sitting there eating ribs like two tables away from me. I mean, it was just bizarre. And I heard about it like the day before it happened, and my dad called me and said he'd heard it on the radio. And this was like really not pre-internet completely, but just about, you know, 1990.
Yeah.
And so there was no way to really like look it up or anything. And so my sister Jo and I just called the radio station a few times and got through, and we got tickets to it.
Amazing.
So it was incredible. So I count that among my shows.
Oh, yeah. I would too. And of course you saw them on the Foo Fighters thing.
The Taylor Hawkins. Taylor tribute Hawkins show.
Tribute.
And, oh,
yeah.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. That was. I can't even describe how that felt, because
I mean, for their first time performing after Neil's passing for another drummer who had just passed.
Yeah.
Holy cow. That's just, it intense.
Everyone was crying. Everyone was emotional. You know, I went with a guy named Carlos Costa from the Rush tribute band Natural Science out in LA, and his girlfriend, Stephanie, the four of us were, and Jerry, you were supposed to come with us.
I know. I couldn't.
That's
come
right.
At the last
and you
minute.
Couldn't make it. Yeah.
I know.
But yeah, it was a really very emotional night seeing them again. And it really helped me, because my final Rush show on R40 was not ideal, because there were two guys next to my best friend and I who had been drinking heavily throughout the night, and their behavior was getting worse and worse throughout the evening. Mm-hmm. And they were hassling us, you know, they were getting too close, they were acting inappropriately, and they were stealing away these precious moments that I was pretty sure would be the last. And so to go back to the Forum, which was where I saw Rush for the very first time in 1990, April 2nd, 1990, and see Geddy and Alex. And Neil's absence was very keenly felt, but to see those guys again, you could feel Neil's presence. You really could.
Yeah.
And to have that come full circle from the very first show to the very last, you know, it was kind of, I don't know, there are lots of emotions there.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, how many times did you see him?
26.
Wow.
So nice.
Steve, my podcasting partner, went two times without me. I couldn't go to two shows. So he's
wow.
Been two more.
And you were all, but the rest you saw with him?
Yep.
That's so cool.
All the other ones. Yep.
That's really
that
cool.
That is so cool. You know, and I didn't think about this at first, but back in the 80s, they would always, when they're doing their spring break tour, they would always come to Florida, and they would always do two nights at the Lakeland Civic Center, which is the biggest at the time, was the biggest. It was a 10,000 seater. And I would always go two nights, because one, I would go with friends. And then the second night I would go and I would sit in a place. This is way back in the everything was general admission days. And I would sit where I could just watch Neil.
Of course, as a drummer, you would want to do that.
Right, because I would just study. And, you know, because you're seeing the show one night, so you don't have to worry about seeing the show. And I would just watch. And, oh, my God, I just learned so much. I'm a drummer, too. I just learned so much from just studying him. And it only happened a couple of times, you know, but still, it was so incredible.
Yeah, the first time.
Great way to approach it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first time I saw them, I had never really, I mean, I heard like the radio hits, Tom Sawyer and that kind of stuff, but I wasn't into Rush at all. That was in 86 on the Power Windows tour. And I was sitting Alex's side, really almost at the edge of where they didn't sell seats anymore. Do you know what I mean? Right. Like the back of the stage.
Right.
We were almost out of the theater. And I, you know, I think it was watching Neil too. I just couldn't believe what I was witnessing in front of my eyes, the way he was playing and just the sounds that were coming off of this stage. I was in love with every single song, even though I had never heard them before. I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Right. And it's was that the start of your like super fandom then? Okay.
That from that second on, we drove around that night because the other guys I went with, including Steve, they were Rush fans, you know, casual, but Rush fans. And then Steve and I, we just went insane. We just went crazy.
Yeah.
Basically. I think we drove around that night listening to Exit Stage Left for hours over and over again. I was just like, I cannot believe what I am listening to. Like, where has this been my entire life? I felt like I had I just found a part of myself.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Your soul that had been missing and you didn't even know it.
Didn't even know it was gone. Yeah. I was so happy.
Those kind of memories of driving around afterward. I mean, isn't that like just something you miss so much now?
Yep. I still drive every once in a while and be like, I'm just going to go for a drive and listen to music for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I haven't done that.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. I did it with my my daughters during COVID when we were all stuck in the house. There was nowhere to go. Yeah. So we would just drive.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Man, that's really cool.
Alan, maybe you and I need to hop in the car and drive around listening to Exit Stage Left.
Why don't we? That sounds amazing.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. Let's do it.
Tell me when you're going to go. I'll fly.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Please come. And actually, you know what? You should come in May. We're playing the biggest venue I think we've played so far. It's this beautiful opera house in Griffin.
Really?
And it's like, I can't even believe that. I'm so excited that we're going to play there, but you should come and fly down there. And then we'll all go for a drive and listen to Exit Stage Left. And then,
do you have a special plan for that very big venue that you're going to be playing?
We haven't really thought about it too much yet. We've kind of have some stuff that ideas that we're tossing around, but we probably ought to do something.
If I go and Alan goes, who's playing Triangle? Alan, we're going to have
to. Oh man, it's going to be on.
I'm telling you, man. Oh. You know,
you both crushed it. You know, I don't know. I'd have to flip a coin.
Talk about doing special shows. I mentioned to Vicky one time this, I don't even remember how far back this was, but I said, you know what you should do? You should like announce that you're going to do a show where you're going to play an album from start to finish and not say what the album is going to be. And everybody will be thinking, oh my God, it's going to be, you know, Moving Pictures or it's going to be whatever. And then they get to the show and you play the first album. Yeah. Nobody would ever expect
that. Nobody would expect that at all.
But I think that that'd be so much damn fun.
Right.
We did a surprise album for one of our live streams. We played the entire Hemispheres album.
Yeah, that's
we didn't
right.
tell anyone what it was in advance. But when you said you were driving around afterward, it made me think of one of probably my favorite concert memory of all time was seeing Rush on the Presto tour. So that was my first tour. And this was June 29th. It was the closing night of the tour, I believe.
Wow.
1990. And it was at Irvine Meadows in near LA, which is just one of the, I saw several shows there and it's probably my favorite. It's gone now. They've demolished it, but it was my favorite concert venue. It was outdoors. And when the sun went down and you would see the stars come out and that perfect California breeze, you know, so it just had to be that kind of day. And that day, June 29th, it was that kind of night where the breeze was warm but gentle and the stars were out and the air was clear. And they played Mission, which is my favorite Rush song and song of all time. And when Alex was doing that soaring solo at the end, you know, that's not reflected as much on the record, but when you hear it live, it goes, it extends and you get to hear the whole thing. And his eyes were closed and every, I don't know, it was like the air was just charged with this magical feeling because the stars were out and this guitar is soaring and it was just utter perfection.
Mm.
And when I had taken my friend Rich for his birthday and I fooled him because I told him that our seats were in the nosebleed and they were really four throat orchestra.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I like revealed them when we got there, and I did this whole routine about like, oh my God, we have the wrong tickets. Oh my God, what are we going to do? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, these are four throat orchestra. But after the show, we were just so blown away. And, you know, we had about a 45 minute drive back to my mom's house, and we stopped off at a convenience, you know, 24-hour convenience store, and he gets Cokes for us, and we're sitting in the van, and he snapped a picture of me, and I'm like this with my head bowed and my eyes closed. I'm trying to remember the set list, and I'm just overcome with the awesomeness of the whole night, and he's completely overcome, and we just drove around and the stars, you know, looking at the stars, and it was just one of those magical sort of nights that is hard to replicate.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I wrote down four different shows that were my favorite shows of all the ones I've seen. And two of them were at Jones Beach in, it's on Long Island in New York. And it's on the beach. It's the stage itself extends into the water a little bit. So it's an outdoor amphitheater, which generally don't sound that great.
Yeah.
Amphitheaters, outdoor amphitheaters, especially you would think this one would sound terrible being on the water, just the acoustics you think would be the worst, but they were the best shows. The first one was on Roll the Bones 92.
Oh cool.
That was just fantastic.
Yeah,
it's such a beautiful area. You could see people come up in with their boats, and they just kind of anchor in the water and watch whatever concert. So there's all these boats, it's like a regalia or something like that, right? Out in the water. And then the next time I saw them at Jones Beach was on the Time Machine tour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Moving Pictures. And that was just the best.
What can you say? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so awesome.
You know, two things. One, I remember right before, and I don't know the story behind this, but it was right before they played here on the Time Machine tour, Neil's set was set up at our local guitar center, our music store.
What?
And it was just there.
What?
And it was basically on display, and I did not know about this. And I went in to like buy new drumsticks or a cowbell or some shit. I don't even know. And
cowbell. I walk in,
and there's Neil's drum set. And I was like, oh my God.
Oh my gosh. You have got to be kidding me.
Oh my God. I was blown away. And I just stared at it.
That is unbelievable.
But one of my favorite.
Why was it there though?
I don't remember. Like, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know the story behind
it. That's crazy.
But it blew
me away. Wow. Oh my gosh.
One of my favorite stories. And Vicky, I think I told you this story a while back, but on the R40 tour, this is, we're pretty much all thinking this is the last time we're ever going to see Rush, you know? So we're going, and it's cloudy and rainy. You know, and I'm driving and the traffic is heavy and you know, and it's not raining hard or anything, you know, but it's coming down a little bit. And I just think, oh my gosh, I hope that the weather clears, that the clouds will part, you know, and we'll get that little stream of sunshine, you know, that kind of thing. And then it just hit me. What if they play Jacob's Ladder tonight?
Oh, because they
hadn't played it in like 20 years, right. You know, and it just hit me, and it was like a revelation. I thought, holy shit, they're gonna play. I just know they're gonna play it. And then middle of the show, boom, they play it, and I almost cried.
That is so cool. That was my favorite song on R40 tour. Oh. That was amazing. But I remember that rainstorm that right before the show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So two favorites would be, of course, my first one. The Permanent Waves tour was so cool. I mean, it was just a great set list, and they were at that point where they were just becoming the biggest band, you know, and there was just something really special about it. And of course, having it been like the fourth show I ever saw, you know, I was just mesmerized by every show that I saw, but there was something different about this one. And then as many times as I saw them, there were so many great shows, but R40, there was something really, really special about everything that they did, the way that they did the staging and the way that they did the backward set list. And oh my gosh, just incredible.
It was the greatest concept for it wasn't a farewell tour. You know, they wouldn't do the farewell kind of shtick. But yeah. like you said, you could tell it was going to be the last time they would probably be touring. But that was the greatest idea.
Yeah. And I was thinking, what if their last tour they did a chronological set list? How cool would that be? They did it even better. They did a chronological, but backwards.
Backwards. Right. And, so
but
cool.
not only just the music, but the staging too.
The staging blew me away.
You got to see all of the cool stuff, the dryers and the chicken roasters.
The rotisserie.
Yes.
The rotisserie chicken things. They didn't have the rabbits, I don't think, right? They didn't bring out the rabbits.
No rabbits.
But you know,
it goes
all the way
back to a high school gym.
Right.
For the encore.
I saw them twice on that tour. And the first night, I didn't even pay attention to the stage because I was just listening. Yeah. I'm like, I can't believe they're playing this song. This is the craziest set list ever. They're just going backwards and they're just right.
Yeah.
They played Losing It too when I was there. Jonathan Dinklage came out and played Losing It.
Gosh,
I'm like, this is just getting better and better.
Yeah.
And then the second night, I paid attention to the staging, and it was just the most wonderful thing. Just especially at the end, they're playing. Mm-hmm. They've got the fake amps, the high school gym on like a straight back chair, and they've got the disco ball up.
Perfect.
And it's just the three of them. So cool! What a great idea.
Yeah.
The Epsilon 3 is a dream given form. It's a home away from home for three guys to watch a 90s sci-fi classic TV show. Three guys with microphones over 3,249 miles apart, all alone in the night.
The year is 2262. The place, Babylon 5. The podcast, The Epsilon 3.
On the ESO Network.
I did ask you all to pick your favorite album from each decade because a few weeks ago we did this same kind of show for the 50th anniversary of Kith, and my buddy Matt and I, we picked our favorite album from each decade. So I thought it'd be fun if we did that too. So what do you think, what would you name as your favorite Rush album from the 70s?
So tricky because I'm that Rush fan that loves all Rush from A to Z. You know, I just literally love it all. But I probably have to go with Hemispheres.
Ooh,
that's what I
probably.
That's what I wrote down.
Is it okay?
Yep. Absolutely.
It's a total toss up, but maybe that has like a little edge.
Well, I mean, there's how many songs are on.
Right, exactly. Right?
And they're all just the greatest songs.
Yeah, 100%.
Right. And I went with Farewell to Kings because, you know, it and 2112 are both such transitional albums. They're coming out of that more rock-oriented kind of thing and into bigger concepts and longer song structures and more complex compositions.
Yeah.
And those two together make this perfect, like they're turning a corner into this completely new and different era for them. And there's just something incredibly special about Farewell to Kings.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Mostly Xanadu. Because that is possibly my favorite Rush song.
Well, the great thing about A Farewell to Kings is the stark difference in how it opens compared to 2112.
Yeah.
Again, they could, you know, Rush never repeats themselves. And they could have easily just done another bombastic kind of intro to a song, and instead what do they do, some kind of medieval kind of 12 string with birds chirping in the background. Right.
With one best messages lyrics wise,
right? Mm-hmm. It's not like they even did it on purpose. They're just like, well, we're not going to do that again, let's do something else, you know what I mean?
Love it.
Okay, 80s, what do you say? And there was a lot of stuff happening in the 80s. So this is a lot to pick from.
I can't. I tried. I really did to pick, but I just can't. So because I can't, I'm going to have to go with Show of Hands because it has a little bit of everything on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's so many things from the 80s that I absolutely love, but that has the best version of Mission, which is my favorite song. So I'll have to go with Show of Hands.
Nice. All right, Jerry.
I have to go with Moving Pictures. Moving Pictures is, to me, the best Rush album. It's my favorite Rush album. It's just amazing from second one to second last. It's the it's one of the greatest albums ever recorded in my mind.
Agreed. I will say agreed, but I'm going a little earlier and I'm going to Permanent Waves and talk, you know, this is another transitional album where they're coming out of sort of like, they still have that prog edge to them, but they're becoming a little more commercial and they're becoming, you know, writing songs that radio can pick up, you know?
Right.
And I find it to be just about the perfect Rush album because it's got things like Spirit of Radio, but then you still have things like Jacob's Ladder and Natural Science.
Natural Science.
Oh my God. Anytime Spirit of Rush plays Natural Science, I just go into my world. But
me too, honestly. It's the first Rush song I ever heard. So it always, whenever we're playing it, I'm sitting there going, is this really happening? Am I playing this song? This is the first Rush song I ever heard. And now we're actually playing, I don't know, it's very dissonant in my head. It's really,
I think it's the craziest Rush song in their entire discography. It's the craziest. It's like, what is going on in this song?
What is happening?
This is like the third part of this song.
Yeah,
it's like the strangest thing ever. It's like it's four songs in one, and then this part is just insane. And then Getty's voice, the lyrics come in with that kind of it's not delay. What's the opposite of delay?
Yeah,
when it comes that in before, sort of, you know,
right.
I don't even know what you would call that.
You can
hear like his voice like rushing in.
Exactly.
And it's just the kookiest tune. The kookiest tune.
It is. And the time signatures are so bizarre that I really didn't know how I was going to come in on time. For that part, like I had to work with our bassist and drummer to help me figure out like what is the cue for me to come in, because I'm going, I couldn't count it, I couldn't, and they helped me find like a good drum cue to like come in on time. But yeah, that song is out there,
and you get some great Alex solos.
Oh, so. Like several of them.
Like several, I was gonna say like three of them.
The first time Vicky ever was on my show, which was back in when I was doing a YouTube show and we did our Rush thing, and we did our little countdown of our favorite Alex solos. You remember that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We had so much fun doing that.
We had so much fun because we talk about Alex. I could talk about Alex. Like, don't even get me started on that subject because I'll take up the entire podcast.
We can do that. We can do that. Okay.
Sounds
so
good.
Let's move on through the 90s. Favorite Rush album from the 90s?
Again, hard to pick. This is really tough because I'm really partial to Roll the Bones because it has a very special meaning in my life. Like at the time it was released, I just remember hearing Dreamland on the radio for the first time. And but Counterparts, I think I gotta go with Counterparts.
Okay. I'm going with Counterparts as well.
Okay.
Oh snap. It might be unanimous.
Oh,
really?
Myself.
Okay.
And that's interesting because I'm kind of really drawn to a couple of tracks on Test for Echo, Driven and the title song, I think are just some of the best. Well, that and Ghost of a Chance on Roll the Bones, I think is just about the best stuff that Rush did in the 90s. But there is something, there's really, Counterparts is so cohesive.
Yeah.
And it's just strong from start to finish. So it gets my vote.
Yeah, for me, you know, it's just another example of them kind of filtering pop culture and current music through their own lens and coming up with a Rush-like, I wouldn't say grunge album, but it was in that grunge era, so it was very, you know, guitar-heavy. I would say a return to form, but they never left their form.
Not a return to form. Form is that they're returning to.
Yeah,
right, there's no form to return to. It's a great heavy album. I think Alex, you know, was very happy that that album had just straight ahead kind of plugged in guitars.
Yeah.
Finally.
He had some great solos in there.
Yeah.
I remember the first single from that was Stick It Out and I hated it.
Did
I was like, oh my God, this is so awful. This is not what I want to hear Rush doing. So at first I didn't warm up to the album at all, but Animate sucked me in.
Yeah.
Holy cow, I love that song so much.
Me too. Yeah, we just started playing that like about a month ago. And it's
I was so happy to hear you do that.
My heart just pounds when we kick it off, and yeah.
But you also recently started, I think it was recently, started doing Dreamline too.
Or
had you done that before?
But yeah, for about a year,
in a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't do it too often, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that one too.
Yeah. It's a great song.
So 2000s favorite Rush album.
I'm going to have to go with Snakes and Arrows Live.
Yeah.
Because I love Snakes and Arrows, and Snakes and Arrows Live just took those songs and amplified them even 1,000 times more with the live version. Mm-hmm. The way the wind blows on Snakes and Arrows is great, but Snakes and Arrows live version of that is just like mind blowing. Like Alex is just, you know, wailing on the blues riffs on that song. And
yeah,
I don't know. They just took everything to the next level from that album. And it has Mission on it too, and Digital Man, and all kinds of cool other stuff besides the Snakes and Arrows material. But I just think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
This one's hard because Snakes and Arrows is really what brought me back into, hardcore Rush fandom to me. Like Vapor Trails, I wasn't really too keen on Test for Echo, and then Vapor Trails, you know, didn't sound so great.
Right.
But Snakes and Arrows sounded great. And, you know, with Nick Raskulinitz at the helm, he just brought something new. A youthful energy to the band.
Oh, totally.
But you know, the remixed Vapor Trails is a great album. So I think I'm going to say Vapor Trails.
And you know, Jerry, when I heard your podcast on Vapor Trails, it took my love of Vapor Trails to the next level. Mm. I always loved it, especially the remixed version. But when you have a real gift for analyzing lyrics, and hearing your take on the lyrics of Vapor Trails just really kind of elevated my appreciation of it, which I already had, but it just really took it another, you know, several notches up.
Oh, thanks.
So, thanks.
Oh, I appreciate that. And yeah. I hadn't listened to Vapor Trails before doing those episodes since it came out, because I was just like, it didn't do anything for me. And I never listened to the remixed version when it came out, because I'm like, what is it? What is that? A remixed version of a Rush album. I don't know. It really didn't.
Yeah.
And when I listened to it, I was like, wow, I can't believe I haven't been listening to this album for so long. This is crazy. What have I been missing?
I know. The only thing that I didn't like on the remix, or that I liked better on the original Vapor Trails, was the final song, Out of the Cradle. There's this cool riff that Alex does that somehow they just took it off on the remixed version. And your ear is just dying for it, and it literally isn't there. So what I did is I made a playlist that I called Vic's Vapo Trails, and it's everything.
That is hilarious. Oh my God.
And it's all the songs from the remix version except Out of the Cradle from the original. And it's perfect. So I'll share that with you if you want.
That is so funny.
All right, so I'm following Vicky's lead, and I'm going with Snakes and Arrows Live. And I almost went Rush in Rio, because that was such a great set list, and the audience was so insane, you know. But I think that Snakes and Arrows Live has a better sound quality to it, and it's still a great show, and there are some surprising song picks in it. So I think that's where I'm going with that one. Okay, 2010s.
Got to be Clockwork Angels for me.
Clockwork Angels, right.
My God, yes, absolutely.
What a masterpiece.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you had asked...
when that came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you had asked...
And I'm slow internet, and I'm like, come on, download! My God!
Oh, my gosh, that's funny.
If you had said, you know, 1990s through the 2010s, I might have put Clockwork Angels as my favorite one.
Yeah. I definitely would. 100%. 100%. If you have a career that epic, that long, that meaningful, and you have to close it out, I don't think they could have picked a better album.
No.
A better way to close out their legacy, their catalog. I mean, that album is so incredibly special to me.
It is. It's incredible. And from like every single song, I mean, there's nothing on there that's not like a masterpiece, and how it flows together. And
But after so much of the 90s, where they really got away from, you know, there were hints that said, we used to be a prog band, but only little hints, you know, like an odd time signature in here or there, you know, but it was really a very different thing. And Clockwork is really where they're like, you know what, we can be that stuff that we did in the 90s and the 2000s, and we can be prog too.
Right.
Yeah. And it was almost like a perfect summation of what Rush had done for their entire career. And for a final work by an important band like this. And, you know, when you talk about Neil Peart and his life, the final artistic statement that he released, that he worked on before his passing, this is it, man. This is, oh my God. And that tour was so great.
It was.
That was the greatest tour. That's the tour in which I had that bizarre experience of, you know, meeting Rush and having a premonition that I was going to meet them, and then winning the meet and greet contest and the whole thing with the,
Right.
That was like a magical, bizarre turn of events that just, I'll never forget as long as I live.
Yeah. The song Clockwork Angels. It's so great. But everything on that album is just perfect.
Truly.
Yeah. Truly. I think Headlong Flight is like
the
prototypical Rush song. It has everything.
It is great. Rush song they had done in years.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's got a little drum solo in it. It's got crazy guitar solo in it. It's just amazing. And it's really a song about, you know, life in general.
Yeah.
What a headlong flight there. You know, this character, you know, it's the only Rush album that's an actual full concept album.
Yes.
Which is a strange thing to do, as their last album.
Right.
We would expect nothing less from them, right? After all of these years, just like, let's actually do a concept album finally.
And okay.
And it spawned a couple of novels. It spawned a graphic novel.
Yeah.
And there's so much to it. It's so rich. Oh, my gosh. All right, so to close us out, both of you have really worked extensively within the Rush fan community, one playing in a tribute band and bringing Rush music to audiences, and the other doing a podcast, analyzing Rush music and talking about Rush music and embracing the fans' love of this music. What has it meant to you to be sort of ambassadors of Rush to the Rush audience?
I'm not sure I can express that properly, because it means so much to me to be able to see the faces of these people who come to our shows, who haven't been able to ever hear Rush if they are too young to have ever seen them, or B, miss them so much and, you know, not have the chance to ever see them again. I feel like, especially because the world has been sort of a dark place, you know, the last several years with COVID and political division and all these things. And I feel like if I can bring joy to people in a dark time, then I have met my mission in life. You know, I could kind of die tomorrow and I'd feel like I did something for others. And the looks on people's faces that come to our shows when we nail their favorite song or whatever it is a feeling that I've never had before about anything else. You know, the ability to make people that happy on a consistent basis is a treasure. It's a treasure of a life.
Wow.
I think for me, you know, when Steve and I started the podcast, we had no idea that we were stepping into this world. We didn't really know. We considered ourselves huge Rush fans. We're not huge Rush fans.
Right.
We're not even in the top, 10% of Rush fans. I don't know. There's some people are so into Rush. And the thing that I like about it is there's there are people who are really into Rush and they have nobody to share that with. Like I said at the beginning, when you first get into Rush, you want to tell everybody, but not everybody wants to hear it. And I've gotten so many emails from people who were just like, I don't have any friends who love Rush. I don't have anybody to talk to Rush about. And people want to talk about Rush. They want to share their love of Rush with people. So they listen to the podcast and they say they feel like they have someone to share Rush with. And that's so true. Steve and I are very humbled by the response we get from people. We've gotten emails. I think one of the last emails we read on our most recent episodes was someone from South Africa. He doesn't have any Rush friends, they call him. Mm-hmm. And he just loves the podcast because he has someone that he feels like he can, I don't know, even though he can't bounce ideas off, this is parasocial relationship between people, but he feels like we're talking to him about his favorite band and he's in the conversation, which I just think is amazing.
Yep.
I love that. And if I can add, Jerry, to something that you do for the Rush community, you and Steve, is that you bring back love for albums that maybe people had forgotten about or maybe never completely appreciated in the first place.
Yeah.
And they listen to your podcast when you did the deep dives on the albums. And there were several emails I remember you reading on the air that talked about people all of a sudden like having a flood of love for that album again. Yeah. Or, you know, like, oh my gosh, I never appreciated Grace Under Pressure until you talked about it in the way that you did.
I know.
So yeah, the elevation of that, you know, for all those fans, it's really pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Rush fan's dream come true, right? Cornering somebody in a party and being like, let me tell you why. Power Windows.
You need to listen to Grace Under Pressure. Yeah.
Anybody who says that they dropped off like around Power Windows, listen to me for a second, young right. man. And yes. We've had people who are just like, I have never listened to whatever, Hold Your Fire. I haven't listened to it in 20 years or whatever since it came out. And I decided to listen to it after you guys were talking about it. I'm like, wow, it's a great album.
Yeah.
That is amazing. And I don't understand people who do that, but you know, the fact that you bring them back into the fold is amazing.
Yes. All right. Thank you both so very much for joining me for this conversation about Rush. My God, I love passionate fans, and all three of us have a distinct passion for this band. And it was such a pleasure to spend this time with you. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was nice seeing you both again.
Yeah, you too.
You too as well. So before we leave, Jerry, why don't you tell people where they can find Something for Nothing?
Well, we're available on all your fine podcast apps. Anywhere you want to just search for Something for Nothing will come up if you're a Rush fan.
Sweet. And Vicky, where can people follow Spirit of Rush?
So we are on Facebook and Instagram, Spirit of Rush Atlanta on Facebook and Spirit of Rush ATL on Instagram. We're on YouTube and we have a website forthcoming that you guys are the first to hear about it, actually.
Oh, dear. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working on it right now and it should be live like pretty soon. So.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Very
more,
cool.
More to come.
All right. So thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed this. Drop us a line and let us know your thoughts about Rush. And if you want to hear more of these kind of episodes, you can email us at modernmusicology1@gmail.com or just find us on our socials and drop us a note. We will be back next week. We have a very special interview that I'll be telling you more about later, but join us for that. And then after that, we are going to be changing our schedule a little bit. We are going to be going into a bi-weekly schedule instead of weekly shows. Life schedules have just kind of almost become, you know, they're a little busy. So we are going to just for a little while, we're going to go bi-weekly. So I'm sorry that we won't have episodes as often as we have had for the last 3 years, but we're still going to be bringing great content every show. All right. Thank you all for listening. Everybody take care. And as we say in the Rush fan community, rush on.
Rush on.
Rush on.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.